Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen. I'm your host today, Andre Rodatis, and with me are my wonderful co-hosts and partners in crime, Marvin Gowron and Chuck Thurston. Good morning, guys.
Morning, Andre.
Howdy, gentlemen.
How are you guys?
Here we are in an all-male cast here, missing our wonderful Paula Thompson for a good call.
Yeah.
Why
is she gone
jackets?
For just the little occasion of her wonderful daughter, May, having gotten married yesterday? Congratulations, Paula.
Congratulations,
Shankar.
Yeah, to May and Shankar and all of their families just celebrating that a very special event of May's and Shankar's wedding. That's just been... I won't say fairy tale, but it's just been wonderful. Paula sharing with us as they've moved along in the growth of their relationship and gotten to this amazing juncture. What a wonderful occasion something like a wedding is in a family. It's so meaningful.
It is, absolutely.
Yes,
one of those major milestones in life.
That's right. That's right.
One of the
amazing.
Good ones.
Yes, indeed.
Well, terrific. Well, congratulations to the wonderful parents as well, you know, Glenn and Paula, and to Shankar's wonderful family.
Uh-huh.
The Sridhar family. Congratulations.
Yeah, and I think,
go ahead.
I think they're from, is it Bangladesh? I have a very vague memory where they're from. It's either India or Bangladesh. Do you know, Andre or Chuck? I can't remember.
Well, yeah, it's India. I'm pretty sure it's India, and I believe it's South India. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but we miss Paula, and she'll be back next week. So we're excited for her and for May and Shankar, and and their whole family. But we miss our wonderful Paula. She's such a wonderful and juicy part of our conversations. But I think we'll manage between the three of us. I think we'll manage.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Yeah. Hate to think that we'd all fall apart just because Paula's not here, but we do love her, and she is that wonderful, beautiful feminine aspect of this show, and exemplifies so well how God is so important to all of us, regardless of gender or anything else, any other consideration. I've always appreciated not only Paula's femininity, but her remarkable study of the book. She's really, you know, people are so impressed by Paula's interpersonal skills that they really don't always notice just what a scholar of the Urantia book she is. And she is. She's really a beautiful scholar of the teachings of the Urantia book. So we will see her next week. And I will just go, we'll say it at the end of the show as well. But next week we've got an interesting show coming up. Do you want to say something about it, Marvin, just briefly now and before we get into our last segment here on the spirit and the flesh?
Yeah, I could. I also wanted to say it's kind of a, kind of meaningful and a little odd, a little ironic that when Paula was saying that she had this difficult choice between spending the morning after this great wedding celebration with May, and that was important to her for his mom and daughter, and here we are finishing up the paper on the universe mother spirit. You know, it's just kind of a wonderful coincidence, but she was sad that she was going to miss this final section, but we'll manage. I think we'll do okay without her, but her presence is in a sense sort of supplemented by the fact that we're focused on the feminine aspects of God and the nurture of the spirit in so many ways in our lives, as the mother, the maternal aspect of God. So we miss you, Paula, but we know our you know, as Thomas Roquette likes to say, we know that Mom is with us. So there's compensation. And next week, Saturday, we're still shaping up, but I think we're likely to do a show that focuses on an event that's going to happen on the following Sunday. So not tomorrow Sunday, but a week from tomorrow. And that is the kickoff worship service for kind of a project that a number of us, including Paula and I, have been working on for, oh golly, a couple of years off and on. Yeah, and the name of it is Homecoming, a spiritual family gathering. And we'll say more about that and maybe toward the end of the show. And then we're hoping to have a number of guests from the Homecoming Vision team who are myself and Paula and Elizabeth Callahan and Angie Thurston and Alice Wood and a very good friend of ours, Will Rucker, who is not a UB reader but is a an interfaith minister, wonderful human being, and a really good friend of mine locally here. So I'm going to reach out, and we'll hope to have some, if not all, of those folks participate in next Saturday's Cosmic Citizen Show, and we'll talk about the Homecoming venture and what we're hoping to do with that worship service. So stay tuned. We're kind of looking forward to it.
That sounds good.
It should be fun.
Sounds like a wonderful program. Look forward to hearing and learning more about it. Of course, I have been on the QT as part of the UUI team, been learning some of that, but it'll be fun for our listeners to learn more about it toward the end of the show. Yes, Chuck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you trying to say something.
No, not really.
Oh, you weren't? Okay. Then I'm just hearing things. I'm just anticipating too much. Well, let's do something uncharacteristic. Let's dive right into section 7. We may as well. We're here. We've been studying this wonderful paper on the Mother Spirit. And, you know, we had a wonderful discussion last week on the Spirit in man. Among the takeaways there, the Spirit never drives, only leads. If you're a willing learner, if you want to attain spirit levels and reach divine heights, if you sincerely desire to reach the eternal goal, then the divine spirit will gently and lovingly lead you along the pathway of sonship and spiritual progress. Every step you take must be one of willingness, intelligent, and cheerful cooperation. The domination of the spirit is never tainted with coercion or compromise by compulsion. So in that spirit, would one of you guys like to take up the spirit in the flesh and read through that? It's a short 8-paragraph section there.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, go for it. I wonder if I could just throw in one comment here. Follow up on what you just read. I'm glad you highlighted that paragraph. And I think it's really interesting because the next paragraph, that paragraph says, the Spirit never drives, it only leads. And then the opening sentence of the next paragraph talks about a life of Spirit guidance. It's, you know, when such a life of Spirit guidance is freely and intelligently accepted. I've mentioned this before, but I've always been intrigued by these two ways that the Spirit has to help us find our way. And one of them is through leading, and then the other one is through guidance. So that's going to come up again at the end of this section 7 we're about to read. Maybe, and we'll get probably some discussion and insight from that as well, no doubt. But just
hold
that distinction in mind, I think it's an interesting, because the book uses those two terms in specific ways. You know, usually it talks about the adjuster influences of leading and the spirit of truth influence as guiding. I mean, not, you know, 100%, but in a general way.
Say that again.
So in
say
this
that
section,
again. Which,
they're talking
say that
about
again,
the
Chuck?
Spirit. What's that?
Say that again. Which influences were guiding, which leading? Say that again.
Oh, okay. Yeah, from what I've noticed from, you know, reading the book is that generally they refer to the adjuster influence as leading.
Uh-huh.
You know, the leading of the inner, you know, inner presence, inner spirit. And the influence of the spirit of truth, they tend to refer to more as guidance, which kind of makes sense given the spirit of truth is Jesus. He's been human. He's our brother. He's our father, our friend, you know. He stands next to us. He guides us. He blazes the trail, they say, about Michael or Jesus. Whereas the adjuster is within us. So usually we refer to that influence as a leading influence, like the idea of picturizations of destiny and that sort of thing that they associate with the adjuster. So I just think it's interesting that both come up here in these two paragraphs in the context of the spirit. As they explained earlier, you know, we sort of see that as all the influences maybe taken together. You know, as they say, all the influences, all the spirit endowments are unified in our experience. So when they talk about the spirit, what I'm getting from that is that they're referring to this unified influence of
I got that question.
Endowments. What's that?
Just a quick question. Then, so if they use the word leading to signify the adjuster or sort of the work of the first source and center and guidance as this work of the second, the sun influence, spirit of truth, do they use a word typically in association with ministry of the third source of center, the angels and other mother spirit related ministries, typically, from what you've noticed?
Well, not in, maybe in the same pairing, but certainly that's, you know, often referred to as ministry. and that the Holy Spirit they describe as a pervading influence. So that's interesting, I think. In other words, the adjuster is an indwelling influence. The spirit of truth is described in one place as an enveloping influence, and then the Holy Spirit they refer to as a pervading presence. So we have, you know, a presence within, we have presence that's with us, you know, like Jesus, but then we also have this pervading presence, which I think is such an interesting term to use to refer to the Holy Spirit or the Mother Spirit's presence, because
that's
we know she's present everywhere. Yeah, she's present everywhere. So, yeah, it's a wonderful kind of threefold symmetry of endowments. I mean, they've got us covered, you know, they got us on the inside, they're like next to us, and they're pervading, you know, it's wonderful if we can, you know, focus our minds to, you know, kind of appreciate those distinctions and try to sense them in some way. It really helps me to have
It's interesting. For me, and I'm curious from the two of you, I want to share a couple of paragraphs from that previous section, too. And it's good that we're sort of reviewing this previous section, the spirited man, because I think it flows so naturally into the next section. But the idea of the thought adjuster being at the very center and core of us, it's almost interesting to get a sense of the three persons of the Trinity and their ministry to us as almost like geolocating how they function, or feeling them almost spatially or geographically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, for me, the presence of the Father, at least here way at the edge of the super universes, is at the very center. They say the adjuster is at the nucleus. And so the adjuster is leading us from the deepest place inside.
Mm-hmm.
Which has a feeling associated with it that is very special for me, I'm sure for many of us. And the Spirit of Truth, Jesus, they say, is among us. Whenever two or more are gathered, Jesus is with us and among us. So Jesus is not inside of us, but very closely associated alongside is how I tend to feel it. And then the presence of the Mother Spirit and her angels, they say the angels work in the social environment. So, I mean, that's another sort of geolocation. But the sense of the Mother Spirit as her ministry is as pervasive, almost like she is suffused in our very nature, in the fiber of our being, the ground of our being, our minds and our bodies and our Marantia essence. And so that has a very different feel to it as well, different from deep within and different from among us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really quite delicious, these different ways.
Well, you know, there's a long-standing debate in theology about whether God is immanent or transcendent. Right.
As
if God can't be both. But then what the Urantia throws in addition to those two is God is also associative. You know, we can associate with God.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of, at least as I understand it, that's more like the spirit of truth aspect. And the adjuster maybe is the transcendent aspect, and then the Mother Spirit is the immanent maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
But
no,
that,
yeah.
Again, you have a triad. You have a triad of influence.
Go ahead, and then I'll share one more thought. Go ahead, Chuck.
Okay, yeah, just to attach on to what you're saying, this idea that I have about the Spirit of Truth being an enveloping presence comes from 657. I could just read this paragraph. Really, it's one of my favorite paragraphs in the book. They say that though the Eternal Son cannot personally participate in the bestowal of the thought adjusters, he did sit in council with the Universal Father in the eternal past, approving the plan and pledging endless cooperation when the Father, in projecting the bestowal of the thought adjusters, proposed to the Son, quote, let us make mortal man in our own image, unquote. And as the spirit fragment of the Father dwells within you, so does the spirit presence of the Son envelop you. While these two forever work as one for your spiritual advancement.
Oh, nice. Sure.
Yeah, isn't that, I love that, how that creates that kind of divinity tension, you know, what's within us and what's, you know, sort of a enveloping companion presence. It's like
almost the mother-son aspect there, isn't there? You know,
mm-hmm.
that, you know,
in a way.
Our mothers,
mm-hmm.
our mothers are constantly holding us in our youth and moving us forward and guiding us and nurturing us. And our fathers, you know, they may be a little more hands-off at first, although modern-day fathers are much more hands-on than many of our fathers were in the past. But as the child grows, starts leading them into the world a little bit more, and especially in primitive cultures and where initiation rites are still there, you see that very prevalently. There's no hard and fast kind of thing, especially in our time of gender fluidity, but it is interesting to note these different ways. I mean, the different ways we are loved are significant.
Yeah.
You know, it's all love, but it's significant that the love comes at us in different ways, that we might receive it differently, that we might grow a little bit differently from it.
Well, where I was going to go, it ties really wonderfully in with what all three of us have been talking about and what you just talked about, Andre. And that is, you know, if you're looking for ways of, in a sense, geolocating the nature of God's love and God's ministry to us in the three primary ways, in the many ways that God ministers to us. And geolocating is a funny thing, but it's a sense of geography or place or position where the ministry is originating and how it's functioning, almost spatially or positionally with us. If you take that approach, one additional way, and I want to share a couple of paragraphs from this last section that we read, The Spirit and Man. One other way is that while God is at the center of each of us, God is at the center of all reality on paradise as well. And as you were saying, Andre, there is a powerful, and this goes along with, I think, the paternal love. There's a powerful sort of reaching out and challenging and saying to us, stretch. You all of my children, reach for me, you know, hunger for me, stretch to reach out for me and begin to make the journey back toward my central presence, my original and creative presence on paradise, my originating and drawing presence on paradise. And the Father is saying that to us. He's saying, all right, you know, I've made you. I minister to you along with my cohorts in the Trinity. Now begin to journey back to us and join us here at the center of things. And there are these two paragraphs in this section, The Spirit and Man. It's the second and third paragraph. I'm just going to read them because one other thing. You guys knew Dave Elders, right? I mean, he's
yeah.
passed on to the mansion worlds, and he and his wonderful sweetheart, Marta, who just recently passed on. Dave had this, Dave Elders, who had a unique philosophical mind, and bless his heart, he's a wonderful human being, wonderful brother, look forward to seeing him. He had this concept that I love that he called the divine bungee jump. I think I've shared that before. What he said was that God places us down, you know, on a tether, in a sense, all the way down at the very, very edge of reality, of spiritual reality. And it's like he sends us on this long bungee drop down almost to the ground, you know, not quite merging with animal nature entirely, but still at the very edge of spiritual reality. And then he has this tremendous drawing power that works with us to begin our journey back toward the origination of the big drop, in a sense. And so I love that image of the bungee jump. And here are these two paragraphs. It's 34, 6, 2, and 3. Although divinity may be plural in manifestation, in human experience, deity is singular, always one. It's the second and third. It's the third and fourth paragraph, sorry. From the heights of eternal glory, the divine spirit descends by a long series of steps to meet you as you are and where you are, and then, in the partnership of faith, lovingly to embrace the soul of mortal origin and to embark on the sure and certain retracement of those steps of condescension, never stopping until the evolutionary soul is safely exalted to the very heights of bliss from which the divine spirit originally sallied forth on this mission of mercy and ministry. Spiritual forces unerringly seek and attain their own original levels. Having gone out from the eternal, they are certain to return thereto, bringing with them all those children of time and space who have espoused the leading, and there you go, Chuck, the leading and teaching of the indwelling adjuster. Those who have been truly, quote, born of the Spirit, unquote, the faith sons of God. Ah, those paragraphs, I love them.
Yeah, I'm so glad you read that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found an answer to your earlier question about maybe a description for the influence of the seraphim. Really matches up with what you just brought to our attention there. And it's also very interesting in relation to what they say about the adjuster. But I'll just read this little bit. It's from paper 39, section, paragraph 7, it's a paper about the seraphic host, where they say, it is not possible for angels to attain God from the human level of origin, for they are created, quote, a little higher than you. But it has been wisely arranged. While they cannot possibly start up from the very bottom, like we do, the spiritual lowlands of mortal existence, you know, out on the fringe, like you're just describing, they may go down to those who do start from the bottom and pilot such creatures step by step, world by world, to the portals of Havana. So here they describe them, the seraphim, as piloting us, which I think is wonderful, that they know, they kind of, I mean, they draw on all of spirit influence, and particularly the adjuster. If you recall from reading about the seraphim, they say there's this mysterious unity in the activity of the adjuster and the seraphim, but they don't know how it happens. They just observe it and notice it. You know, there's no obvious communication that one could see going on between the adjuster and the seraphim, but they somehow have this marvelous working unity. I don't know if you guys remember reading that, but it's one of
the intriguing things.
There's
a complementarity.
When they say that they pilot us, that from that I remembered this comment where they say, mind is your ship, the adjuster is your pilot. The human will is captain. That's 111:19. So here they're referring to the adjuster as our pilot, and what I just read about the seraphim, they're saying that the seraphim pilot us, but I have a feeling since they use the same term for both, that's kind of a way of pointing to the unity of that influence.
The
seraphim work in coordination with our adjuster.
It's interesting. It's like there are all these nuances of how the spiritual influences move us along.
Yeah, they're all a little different flavor.
And that word teaching, which is in there in the paragraph we just read too, that's another type of guidance. And I'm remembering that many of our instructors are of the angelic orders. As we move along in the ascension career, many of our teachers are angels, along with the Melchizedeks and others of the sons, are also teaching us. So there's leading, there's guiding, There's teaching,
piloting,
all these interesting verbs they use to talk about the influence of the Spirit in our lives. It's really neat. A lot of flavor.
Yeah. I tend to think of the seraphim almost being more like coaching. I mean, they pilot, but they also have this, you know, they're looking out for our character, you might say. You know, they keep us challenged. They make sure that our, you know, we're not having too easy of a time, because then we won't grow, right? We won't face things that we've never done before. So they're always encouraging that sort of thing in a loving way, of course. when we're actually with them, then it's going to be really something, you know. But I think there is almost like a coaching aspect to it. Might be hard, but you can do it, you know, kind of thing.
That's a great term, Chuck. You know, because I don't see the agencies, like the thought adjuster, coaching would not feel right. And it doesn't feel right for the Spirit of Truth that Jesus is here coaching us. But with the angels, yeah, it's almost like they're alongside us, cheering us on, mm-hmm. encouraging us on, and saying, you know, go for it. You know, and it's almost like they're our teammates in many senses. So,
right.
Yeah, that's,
and we know
they
have some way of manipulating, they say. Is that the word they use? Manipulating the environment.
right.
To, you know, coach our souls.
They definitely do that.
Yeah.
And especially our social environment, they say.
Right.
Which means our relations and our teamwork, our relations with each
mm-hmm.
other.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, how they
well,
do
Andre,
that
you know,
is kind of mysterious.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Chuck and I, we've been sharing some passages. Andre, maybe you could read the section coming up. It would be great if you're up for that.
Yeah, sure. If you guys are ready for me to do so, I will launch in. We're almost
go for
to 40 minutes, so
yeah, we get
<there's...
laughs>
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of tie-ins to others. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got plenty of time for discussion today, and Chuck, we'll probably have time for your wonderful suggestion from paper 17, but here we go. 34:7, the Spirit and the flesh. The flesh, the inherent nature derived from the animal origin races, does not naturally bear the fruits of the divine spirit. When the mortal nature has been upstepped by the addition of the nature of the material sons of God, as the Urantia races were in a measure advanced by the bestowal of Adam, then is the way better prepared for the Spirit of Truth to cooperate with the indwelling adjuster to bring forth the beautiful harvest of the character fruits of the Spirit. If you do not reject this Spirit, even though eternity may be required to fulfill the commission, quote, he will guide you into all truth, end quote. Evolutionary mortals inhabiting normal worlds of spiritual progress do not experience the acute conflicts between the spirit and the flesh which characterize the present-day Urantia races. But even on the most ideal planets, pre-Adamic man must put forth positive efforts to ascend from the purely animalistic plane of existence up through successive levels of increasingly intellectual meanings and higher spiritual values. The mortals of a normal world do not experience constant warfare between their physical and spiritual natures. They are confronted with the necessity of climbing up from the animal levels of existence to the higher planes of spiritual living. But this ascent is more like undergoing an educational training when compared with the intense conflicts of Urantia mortals in the realm of the divergent material and spiritual natures. The Urantia peoples are suffering the consequences of a double deprivation of help in this task of progressive planetary spiritual attainment. The Kalagasti upheaval precipitated worldwide confusion and robbed all subsequent generations of the moral assistance which a well-ordered society would have provided. But even more disastrous was the Adamic default, in that it deprived the races of that superior type of physical nature, which would have been more consonant with spiritual aspirations. The Rajah mortals are compelled to undergo such marked struggling between the spirit and the flesh because their remote ancestors were not more fully atomized by the Adamic bestowal. It was the divine plan that the mortal races of Urantia should have had physical natures more naturally spirit-responsive. Notwithstanding this double disaster to man's nature and his environment, present-day mortals would experience less of this apparent warfare between the flesh and the spirit if they would enter the spirit kingdom, wherein the faith sons of God enjoy comparative deliverance from the slave bondage of the flesh and the enlightened and liberating service of wholehearted devotion to doing the will of the Father in heaven. Jesus showed mankind a new way of mortal living, whereby human beings may very largely escape the dire consequences of the Kalagastic rebellion and most effectively compensate for the deprivations resulting from the Adamic default of the life of Christ Jesus has made us free from the law of animal living and the temptations of evil and sin. This is the victory that overcomes the flesh, even your faith. Those God-knowing men and women who have been born of the Spirit experience no more conflict with their mortal natures than do the inhabitants of the most normal of worlds, planets which have never been tainted with sin, nor touched by rebellion. Faith sons work on intellectual levels and live on spiritual planes far above the conflicts produced by unrestrained or unnatural physical desires. The normal urges of animal beings and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately overconscientious persons. Having started out on the way of life everlasting, having accepted the assignment and received your orders to advance, do not fear the dangers of human forgetfulness and mortal inconstancy. Do not be troubled with doubts of failure or by perplexing confusion. Do not falter and question your status and standing. For in every dark hour, at every crossroad in the forward struggle, the Spirit of Truth will always speak, saying, "This is the way." And that's presented by a mighty messenger temporarily assigned to service on your rancher. And this was my entrance quote. You know how many of us were asked to read a favorite passage, right, upon entrance to a society, you know, when we became members of societies and whatnot. Well, this was my... And this was my watchword for probably my first 30, 35 years of reading the book.
That one had a profound influence on me as well.
Are you talking about the paragraph or about last paragraph or the whole
that
section?
Last paragraph.
Mainly the paragraph, but, you know, the whole section is poignant, especially for those of us that resonate with conflicts that seem like incessant warfare. I'm not going to deny it. In my youth, that warfare was intense.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is especially meaningful because it is, as they say at the end, presented this whole paper, but this last section is presented by a mighty messenger temporarily assigned to service on your ranch. And I think it's worth noting that a mighty messenger would have been rebellion tested, right? So I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if this particular mighty messenger knows whereof he speaks, because he had the experience, he or she had the experience of being a mortal on a rebellion sphere and having this tremendous tug of war between the animal nature and the spirit nature. And as a result of deprivation of, you know, some of the ministries that would happen on a rebellion sphere, I wouldn't be surprised if this mighty messenger actually has experienced what we experience living in these circumstances, these quite unusual circumstances of being on a rebellion sphere and being deprived not only of the cultural influences of the, you know, a planetary prince center, but of the physiological the animal, the biochemical impacts, really, neurological and biochemical impacts of the Adamic default. So, I mean, this mighty messenger knows whereof he speaks. I mean, he's talking, I think he's talking his own experience as a mortal.
No doubt.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And certainly just even mortal experience, you know, would be enough. But the fact that there's mortal experience in the face of rebellion, that's quite telling, telling.
Yeah. Yeah, I was intrigued by this comment they make in the fourth paragraph. They're telling us, you know, we have this double deprivation. And, you know, we're all familiar, you know, with this idea that the Adamic default deprived us of an uplift, genetic uplift. But this comment about Caligastia, I think, is interesting. It kind of jumped out at me for the first time for some reason, where they say that they refer to the first, that first, you know, revelation as providing, as creating the moral assistance, assistance which a well-ordered society would have provided. And I think that's, I don't know, I think that's super intriguing. I never quite thought of it that way. But to start out from the very beginning with a well-ordered society and then go from there, how that would, I could just almost feel that in my soul, how that would provide moral assistance. You know, there's sort of a standard or ground. You know, we don't go below this line, right? And it's like everybody understands that. Everybody's in agreement. Whatever the principles are that are associated with that or inherent in that are kind of grasped by everyone because the effectiveness is obvious, right? So that provides a kind of low water mark or something. Just a level of behavior that you don't go below. That a well-ordered society would provide that. And that gives this moral assistance, the starting point for everybody, you know, in terms of how they develop their character from that point spiritually. But there'd be this kind of ground of moral standard that would be part of that of well-ordered society. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. I mean, they say the same thing about a well-ordered family. How that really helps the children.
Well, Morgan, I know you've got something to say, so go ahead and say it. But I would like to chime in with some examples that are poignant for me in my own life. So go ahead, Morgan.
Yeah, I think we're all focusing in on this second sentence in paragraph four, which you mentioned, Chuck. And in the earlier parts, you focused on the moral assistance of a well-ordered society, which is an intriguing phrase. But the earlier parts of the sentence are also, to me, really intriguing. They say the Caligastia upheaval precipitated worldwide confusion. Mm-hmm. That is still the state we are in. And they say, and robbed all subsequent generations of the moral assistance. So what strikes me about that sentence is all down through the ages for a half, for, you know, 300,000 years or 250,000 years, all subsequent generations, including our own, are in a state of worldwide confusion. It persists. Our cultures are marked by tremendous confusion and value chaos almost as a result of the lack of the Kalagastia, of the Kalagastia rebellion. And if we had had a planetary center of civilization, our cultures would have been so much more clear and ordered in terms of, we wouldn't have had the value relativism that we deal with in a postmodern world. You know, the confusion of, like, all the hedonism and all of the self-indulgence and the lack of a clear sense of altruistic spiritual goals, you know, that mark our cultures. That's characteristic of a rebellion planet. And we are in the midst of it still. We're still struggling with it. All, you see it all over the place. Look at what's going on in the world. The massive hungering and the, I mean, the shootings, you know, the violence, the self-indulgence to extreme degrees, you know, and the marked deprivation at the other end of the spectrum. It's horrendous. Really, it's on a pretty cosmic scale because of the lack of that societal guidance. So I just struck that sentence as really, I mean, you're right. We think about the Adamic deprivation, and that's just as profound. They say it's more profound because it is even more disastrous, was the deprivation in our actual physical natures. But what a double whammy, you know, the cultural deprivation and the deprivation in our actual mechanism for thinking and experiencing. This section really brings it home, what the state we're in. And then the next paragraph where you say, your ranch are mortal, so they're talking about us in particular, are compelled to undergo such marked strugglings between the spirit and the flesh because we were not more fully atomized. Anyways, go ahead, Andre. It's just really struck by this, these statements. They're so powerful, really. Go ahead, Andre. You have some thoughts as well.
So the thing that strikes me always with that well-ordered society business is, you know, just things that you just can't take for granted in this life with regard to a number of things that maybe it occurred to you ought to have been taken for granted. The first thing that occurs to me was when I was in Catholic school, you know, growing up as a young Roman Catholic boy, I was surprised. I mean, I literally was surprised. It was a revelation to me, a negative one, that all the other Catholic boys were not trying to behave the way they were hearing about Jesus being talked about in the Bible. That it was almost as though there was no difference between a Roman Catholic boy and any other boy, you know, or girls for that matter, that there didn't seem to be any greater behavior. That was an evolutionary revelation to me. It just didn't occur to me that if you were learning that stuff in church and you were supposed to be behaving a certain way, that you wouldn't do that. And, you know, talk about, obviously, it sounds like, boy, who's this Boy Scout here? Well, you know, this naive young man. Well, I mean, I was young, and obviously I learned. And then I no longer expected that kind of behavior. And my own behavior was not exemplary, you know, all the time or anything like that. It's not a matter of that. But it's one of those things that you realize that reality is not the way you suppose it's going to be. Whereas what it almost suggests to me is that my mind had an appreciation that there ought to be that possibility for that to exist in society. I think our minds are patterned that way, at least some people's minds are, to expect a high foundation and to believe that that's possible. Now, so let go of that then. And just imagine how many different things we are absent from our world or our various societies that don't allow us to take certain supports for granted that would then make life easier in the sense of you wouldn't have to worry about those lower order things quite so much and would be freed up to pursue the higher order things. And one of those things is in a well-ordered society that by now would be well in place, both scientifically and otherwise. But just imagine if there were adequate place-finding devices for people. Imagine that your society regarded the work, the service you could perform in society as so valuable that your education would pay attention to you that much to find out what you were good at on the front end. And regardless, on the back end, whatever your abilities were, that you would then be assisted directly, that there would be coordination among employers, industry, government agencies, all of that, to easily facilitate your moving into the right work. And then imagine that the society is well-ordered enough that work is regarded as so important and employees is so important that there isn't this idea of casting them off as though they were just so much flotsam and jetsam, the way, particularly in American society today, workers are considered a dime a dozen. Or, you know, when they're in scarcity, they're a little more valuable. But as soon as they're no longer in scarcity, they're just cast off again. Now, imagine those kinds of, and then what that allows the society to be able to do. And that's just, those are just material supports or moral supports. It doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of all the things that we're missing in our society that could have been in place after 35,000 years of the, you know, evolution of the Adamic regime, not to mention 500,000 years of the evolution of the regime of the planetary prince.
Well, I think you're focusing on something very important, Andre, and as you were talking, I was thinking about the different experiences that many of us have had. You know, I mean, some of us were lucky enough to have almost by accident or by some intention and design fallen into a profession or a vocation that fit our temperaments, that utilized our gifts and developed our abilities so that we could be of service in society and in a way that was recompensed, that was, you know, paid sufficiently well so that we were not struggling materially. Others mm-hmm. of us were not lucky enough to have that happen for us. And you know, I know many of my good friends have struggled with how to find their place in the, you know, the economic part and the vocational part of society in a way that, A, not only used their gifts really well, but allowed them not to be stressed materially. I think the majority of the world's people are not that fortunate. So I think what you're saying, what you're talking about, focused on, Andre, is very important. Mm-hmm. The other piece that occurs to me, I got just a couple more things here. The other piece that occurs to me, is, and I think about this fairly often. I think had the planetary prince and Adamic mission succeeded on our world, we would currently be in a situation where our longevity would be much extended, substantially extended. I'm not saying 400 or 500 years, but maybe a couple of hundred years, right? And our physical natures would have been upset, and our sciences would have been, and our genetic sciences especially, would have been sufficiently upset that we may have had much longer lives, number one, and culturally, there would be institutions that when we got to this stage of life and we realized how important the spiritual growth trajectory was for us, we would actually have the societal support and help for much more in-depth and long-term spiritual growth and development in our relationship with God, in developing our capabilities spiritually, and in developing our service activities, so that we could really mature much further along in the psychic circles and hopefully begin to approach, begin to get to the stages coming up to fusion, you know, the higher circles, the second and first circles, that we would have tremendous societal support and we would have the lifespan necessary to make that kind of progress. As it is, most people, when they get to the point where they really can see the spiritual vistas, you know, they really understand how important that part of life is, their lives end at that point because our lifespans are so short. So I think that's a major difference that would be true for us if we lived in a world that was much better ordered and structured. And then there's one other thing I'm hoping we can focus on. Let's see. It's 3476, the sixth paragraph and seventh paragraph. And there's something that struck me about those two paragraphs that I haven't focused on before. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on it. Let me just read it, and then I'll share the thought. Notwithstanding this double disaster to man's nature, what this has to do with is the fact that when we enter the kingdom or we move into living spiritual family relationships with God and with each other, right, into the spiritual family of God, this equation changes for us. Right, they say it's much easier. So that's what these paragraphs focus on. Notwithstanding this double disaster to man's nature's environment, present day mortals would experience less of this apparent warfare between the flesh and the spirit if they would enter the spirit kingdom, wherein the faith sons of God enjoy comparative deliverance. That's an interesting phrase from the slave bondage of the flesh, in the enlightened and liberating service of wholehearted devotion to doing the will of the Father in heaven. And then they talk about Jesus showing us the way. And then the next paragraph, those God-knowing men and women who have been born of the Spirit experience no more conflict with their mortal natures than do the inhabitants of the most normal of worlds, planets which have never been tainted with sin nor touched by rebellion. Faith sons work on intellectual levels and live on spiritual planes far above the conflicts produced by unrestrained or unnatural physical desires, the normal urges of animal beings, and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, and this last phrase deserves some attention, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons, which is the other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. But the theme I want to...
Read Catholic, young Catholic boys and girls.
Yes.
You know?
And read that, you know, guilt-ridden, fear-motivated, and I'll also read codependent, you know, those who...
Yes.
Who destroy their own self-esteem in the need to take care of others, right, which goes along with the fear and the guilt. All of that is, I think, in the realm. And they talk about the lack of ego cohesion that results with for people who are overly conscientious, and unfortunately. But that's a sub-theme. The thing I wanted to bring up for our consideration is this. I'll just state it as a thesis, and that is that even on normal non-rebellion worlds, there still is some degree of grappling and struggle with a physical animal nature. Like they say in the second paragraph I read, those God-knowing men and women who have been born with the spirit experience no more conflict than with their mortal natures than do the inhabitants of the most normal of worlds. The implication is that there still is some struggle, but it's not the intense struggle we have. It's more of an education, as they say. But the experience of grappling with material nature, I think, is a universal experience even on normal worlds. It's just way less intense. And so it's not a piece of, it's not a cakewalk where they have no problems. And even when we enter the kingdom, I don't think it's a cakewalk where we have no problems. We still have to work things through. But it's not the crazy intense struggle that many people who are at living in materially extreme lifestyles experience and have not. People who struggle without the benefit of a spiritual practice and spiritual life, I think, go through much greater confusion. But people who have a spiritual life still have, I think, experiences of having to deal with it, which are not easy at times. But they're much easier than otherwise. So that's the key point that jumped out at me on this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's another factor too that they hint at here, which I know has been a matter of debate among some readers at different times. But in this comment where they say that they refer to planets which have never been tainted with sin, nor touched by rebellion. The implication there, as I read that, is that normal worlds that are not join the rebellion, sin, there's evolutionary evil, but there's not sin in the sense that Jesus describes in this other reference, paper 148, section 4, paragraph 6, where Jesus says that sin is an attitude of conscious rebellion which was brought to this world by those who fell from spiritual light into gross darkness. In other words, the human race has had to be taught by our rebel, would-be administrators about the rebellion is even possible. In other words, the implication being that it would not occur to the mortals on a normal world to even entertain the idea of rebellion, or even sin, apparently, in the Urantia book's meaning of that term, or what Jesus means by an attitude of conscious rebellion.
So here's two minds on the same track, Chuck, because that's what I was thinking about as well. I think that is so striking a phrase, nor touched by rebellion. Well, okay, but never been tainted with sin, meaning never been tainted with willfully embracing evil. So evil is there. Read it.
No. I'm reading it, but I have a slightly different interpretation that I'd like to share with you all and see what you think.
Okay, I'm girding my loins.
Yeah. Are we girded? Here we go.
I think we are. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the question I'd like to introduce is, or the factor I'd like to introduce is, you can look at those statements in terms of an individual person, individual choices, and an individual life, and you can also look at those same passages in terms of a world on a global level. So here's what I'd like to posit, and that is, on any normal world that has not been rebellion, tainted by rebellion, it's developing normally. The picture I have is that I won't say every mortal, but I would almost say every mortal, not only on rebellion spheres but on normal spheres, has had some experience with not only evil but sin. That not only do we get confused and make stupid mistakes, But we all on even normal worlds as individuals have this experience of being tempted, trying to do good, being tempted by evil, and going against the spiritual grain and choosing what is less than good, true, and beautiful at times, and is selfish at times.
Sure.
But that for most mortals, that choice, the actual choice to behave sinfully, is not the primary choice. It doesn't pervade them. They don't make it over and over and drift into iniquity. They do it occasionally. They have the experience. They learn to resist. They learn to embrace higher spiritual ideals. And they leave sinful activity behind in the long run, right? So that's on the individual level. On the global level, I think, is where they're making the statement that I don't think it happens other than on rebellion spheres, where whole masses of people and whole philosophies of living are developed around the embrace of iniquity and the embrace of sin, that whole societies fall into massive choice of sin, leading to iniquity and depravity. I think that degree of struggle with sin is an aberrant phenomenon characteristic of rebellion spheres. But the fact that people dally with sin and taste it and experience it and have to grow beyond it, I'm of the opinion that's a universal experience on all normal worlds. So there you have
okay,
it.
Okay, can I come back with something on
please,
that?
Please, please.
I don't know.
Please
I don't
go
think
in.
That
I have a feeling this is point, counterpoint. Here we go.
Yeah, right, sort of. Okay. I'm not sure that raises to the level of what Jesus in the Arantia book means by sin. I think it may be worth reading the rest of that paragraph where Jesus makes that comment. He starts out by saying, by nature, before the rebirth of the spirit, mortal man is subject to inherent evil tendencies. But such natural imperfections of behavior are neither sin nor iniquity. Mortal man is just beginning his long ascent to the perfection of the Father in paradise. To be imperfect or partial in nature, in natural endowment, to be imperfect or partial in natural endowment is not sinful. Man is indeed subject to evil, but he is in no sense the child of the evil one unless he is knowingly and deliberately chosen the paths of sin and the life of iniquity. Evil is inherent in the natural order of this world, but sin is an attitude of conscious rebellion which was brought to this world by those who fell from spiritual light into gross darkness. So in other words, that example, Marvin, of knowing better, you know, we know better, but then we don't do better. You know, we're pulled by our urges and tendencies and desires in all kinds of directions, which are not always what we, you know, does not always fulfill our highest wisdom, to say the least. But that's kind of I think that's still in the realm of evolutionary evil, you know, making mistakes, doing the wrong thing. But even when you do that wrong thing, if you recover from it, if you, you know, then eventually maybe recognize that was the wrong thing and then you correct it and go on. I mean, that's, to me, that's all within the realm of evil. What Jesus is talking about here about sin is much, much more serious, I think. Because there's a knowingness to it. And it has to do with, an attitude of conscious rebellion. You know, it's like really, really purposefully using evil as a method or a technique to accomplish something. You know.
Yeah. There's an implication in the statement. I don't think these kinds of statements are made lightly when, you know, a mighty messenger or, you know, any high being is making the statement, the most normal of worlds, okay? So already we're maybe a couple of standard deviations above the norm, you know, the higher 2 or 3% or 6% of the worlds or whatever you want to say. Planets which have never been tainted with sin. Well, never is a pretty absolute term. And when they say tainted, they're trying to underscore the idea, not even a little bit of sin. So to me, what that says is, regardless of evil, there's a big difference when you see somebody directly embrace doing the wrong thing. It's one thing to have made a mistake. It's one thing to have gone into error. It's quite another thing when you see someone knowingly doing the wrong thing. And what that does, what that sets up as a possibility in terms of attitude. Imagine that there are planets there that have grown, and it's maybe not huge, huge numbers. You can imagine sin evolving as a result of somebody's choice without it being introduced from supermortal beings. But still, without having seen that, if it never arises, what that does in terms of the momentum of a planet and how I justify this attitude in the physical world, is it, or in the spiritual world rather, is the example they give literally in physical evolution in celestial mechanics. And I'll put that quote up here shortly, but it's the idea that there is no retrograde motion in space bodies without there being an introduced body outside of the system. In other words, the physics in a normally evolving system will evolve in the plane of creation and all in the same direction. Retrograde motion only happens when another space body intrudes from outside. Well, to me, it's underscoring this idea of how it might be possible that there are normal worlds that have never been tainted by sin.
I hear what you're saying. Yes. The principle, Andre, of you know, the introduction of an outside force that gravitates toward sin and eventually iniquity. Let me share a couple of actual real life examples to put some flesh on the bones of what I'm trying to get at. Let's take I can't think of another example right off. I'm just going to use this example. When I was 19 or 20, I was struggling with something. And it's something that I work with actually in my counseling work. I've worked with it all along in my counseling work with folks. And that is related to the issues of addiction, right? And there's an experience that I had, so it's pretty personal, where there was a period of about a year plus, and I haven't done any kind of drugs or substances that alter my consciousness since I was about 19 or 20. And this is really personal. It may be different for different people, so I'll just say that out front. I had come to the place where I recognized that my spiritual growth and advancement was being inhibited by my use of these substances. And I knew for myself that it was wrong. It was not right for me to continue to use them, that I was keeping myself stuck and non-progressing spiritually as a result of that practice. And I struggled with it for about 1 to 2 years and finally came around to the place where I stopped and never have returned to those practices. But during that time, I was in this situation where I wanted to indulge in those ways, and I knew that it was not good or right for me. I knew that it was wrong for me, and I went ahead and did it anyways. Now, is that evil where I don't understand the implications? Well, let me finish. Or is that...
There's another category, by the way.
or is that dabbling in what I would call sin, which means I understood that it was regressive and it was not progressive for me, and I needed to let it go, and it took me a while to accomplish it. So that's one example. And I'll simply say that's an example that is representative of many, many levels of struggle on many, many issues that normal human beings deal with.
Yeah.
They know something is not right. They keep doing it intentionally. And they either succumb to it and dive deeper into it and lose their sense of well-being to extreme degrees, even suicidal degrees and self-destructive degrees, or they move in the other direction. And that's the issue of repetition of sin, either towards an iniquitous state or a lost state, a spiritually lost state, or moving in the other direction and away from sin back into, you know, some other state that is progressive spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example. The other example is
okay.
The other
I'd
the
love
other
to comment
example.
On that.
But give me a sec because I want to
go ahead.
Yeah, the second example is more drastic. Let's say I was living in 1940s, early 1940s Germany, right, or late 1930s Germany, with the rise of Hitler, right, and I saw what was going on around me, and I faced some deep moral choices, right, and I knew at some level that the kind of terror and destruction and violence that was being perpetrated by the increasing juggernaut of that military madness, right, that societal madness that dehumanized other human beings, made them scapegoats, and that dramatically mobilized for a war of aggression that killed tens of millions of people, if not a few hundred million. I knew that that wasn't right, but I faced choices to either somehow stand against it or go along with it, either grudgingly or to actually embrace those values. And I grappled with it, and I went with it, you know. What would that do to me? And what would result in my personal nature, in my spiritual nature, by consistent choices of brutal evil, and giving into that and eventually embracing that, those to me were very individual choices. Now, that exists in a world where massive sin as a philosophy is what I'm being surrounded by, right? So there we're talking about, I think, a kind of phenomenon that doesn't occur on a normal world, is where a whole society devolves into the madness of Luciferian values. And you see the end result. But in the midst of that, you have individuals struggling with very personal choices of evil and sin and eventual iniquity and depravity, and people making different choices along that continuum. So that's a more extreme kind of explication of some of what we're talking about. So that's enough for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good.
Well, yeah, cool. Yeah, if I maybe just respond to your first example, I think what you're talking about there is still in the category of evil. In other words, we're all heavily influenced by the cultural use of these terms. So particularly, you know, in Christianity and maybe in Judaism as well, there's a whole lot of stuff that's thought of as sin that isn't really sin in the Urantia Book's use of the terms. So these kind of experiences where you give in to an urge to addiction and things like that, those are more in the realm of error. So that's kind of a subcategory of evil is error. And the Imaginable Book points that out. And we're subject to that. We make a lot of errors in judgment, right? But we're not consciously rebelling against God necessarily. In this deliberate and strategic sort of way in those types of decisions. We may be defeating or self-injuring even in those kinds of decisions, but they'll be easily forgiven, you know, or easily. Those are things you'll more have to like kind of forgive yourself over. But I don't think they rise to the level of what the Orange Book means by sin. So, I mean, there's a semantic issue here, in other words, because there's a whole lot of behaviors that we just naturally sort of think of as being sinful because that's how we've been sort of taught growing up. But I think the Orange Book is trying to map out a line to make a distinction between the legacy of rebellion and what's natural on a normal world. So even in a normal world, you know, there's struggles, like you were saying, against potential evil, actual evil of all kinds, particularly in the pre-Adamic stages. But when rebellion is introduced on a world, something changes. That's a big deal because there's a demonstration from, you know, the superhuman leadership of going beyond the boundary that before that you didn't even know was there, in a sense. They're demonstrating a potential for rebellion, which, as Jesus said, is brought to this world. So I hear everything you're saying, and I think those are all good points, but I'm still trying to get a sense of where that line is. Where do things, what influence does rebellion have that creates kind of a new category of behavior that's defined by rebellion, which otherwise wouldn't be on the world if it wasn't, you know, influenced by rebellion. So that's kind of where we're trying to find that. I'm trying to find that line because I think there is a line there.
Let's talk about the line. And what I'll say is I don't think it's a hard, fast, single line. I think it's actually a stretch of territory where there's a gradation, I think, that happens. And let me use the example that I cited earlier. I knew at the time that I was grappling with my use of substances at that younger age, I knew God did not wanted me to stop. and this is very personal,
maybe.
Right? I'm saying in my personal spiritual experience, I had prayed about it, I was a reader of the Orange Book, and I had a pretty clear sense that for me, God's will was to move away from these activities and free my consciousness up and move forward in a direction that was without them. And I knew that. Mm-hmm. Because at least that was my personal working conclusion out of prayer and searching for God's leading. And I still persisted in indulging for some period of the time. And what I'm saying is I don't think sin is a hard, clear, definitive line that's binary. I think it's a stretch of territory that has this characteristic of knowing something is not right or good, and even knowing that God's preference for you is to move in the other direction, and going ahead and persisting in an activity that is less than higher, that is in a stretch of territory that has the quality of sinful. It's not just, I don't understand or I don't know. It's, yes, I know, but I'm not strong enough, or I haven't chosen to really leave this behind. It's a difficult stretch. And I don't want to sugarcoat it. I don't want to say that it's easy. It's not easy. It's hard. And that we either move through that stretch and we persistently choose and consciously choose to go against that subtle, still small voice, in which case we begin to drift across a threshold that is not only sinful but has elements of iniquity until eventually we become iniquitous and we embrace evil in a way that is wholehearted, continuous, and begins to destroy the faith connection. But that's a whole large stretch of territory, and we can move back in the other direction. So I'm saying it's a hard, bright line. I think it's a stretch of territory where we struggle with what we know is right or wrong, and we move in a direction, either towards iniquity or back away from sin and more back into the realm of being free of sin. So anyways, that's a thought.
Yeah, no, I see that. That's, you know, makes sense up to a point. There's actually another reference to sinless spheres, and that's 55:5-1, just to put this together with the other one, where they say, mortal creatures living on a sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, isolated world, such as Urantia, can hardly conceive of the physical perfection, the intellectual attainment, and the spiritual development which characterize these advanced epochs of evolution on a sinless sphere. And
Interesting. That's a great
context for that is in the spheres of light and life. So they're talking about an advanced stage, but nonetheless, the implication of the sentence is that on a sinless sphere, you'll see evolution taking place in these marvelous ways that we can't.
It's interesting that series of adjectives is not being applied to an individual. It's being applied to a world and a world culture,
right,
which is interesting.
Mortal creatures.
Keep reading.
Yeah, living on a world like this.
Right.
Can hardly.
So, in other words, the series of adjectives: sin-stricken, selfish.
Uh-huh.
What's the list? Yeah, those adjectives describe the world, not the individual. In other words,
also describes world, you know, in sinless sphere, and that's pretty remarkable, you know, to imagine that at some point sin has disappeared, even from a world that may have been sinful, and not to mention what we had talked about earlier, which was the idea that there could be worlds that have not been tainted by sin, right? That's so far beyond our experience.
What I'm positing, and you guys are welcome to disagree, is on a normal let me say the positive on a normal world not tainted by rebellion, right? On those normal worlds, individuals do experience some exposure in their own experience, their own choice range, what they do, how they live. They do normally experience not only evil, but some choice of sin, not in the sense of rebelling against God, but in the sense of consciously knowing that what they are doing is not good, true, and beautiful, and God doesn't want them to do it, but they do it anyways to some extent, and they struggle with that. Even on normal worlds, but what has not happened on those worlds is the entire global culture has been impacted by imported sin, and there are whole philosophies and cultures that are submerged in sinful activity. That does not happen on a normal world. That's kind of where I stand on it.
I think what you're positing, Marvin, is true, and is probably true in the name. But we're having being part of our culture and having been exposed to statistics and the bell curve, there is 2, 3, 4 standard deviations above the norm as well. And that could characterize what they're saying, never been tainted by sin. And frankly, I think what you're saying is more about the general psychology of a Urantian and what we experience and what we cannot possibly imagine than what may be the truth of what can occur on certain worlds that have evolved in such a way that sin has not occurred on that world, as defined by the Urantia book, that they overcame evil as part of their evolution. We're talking about a huge data set, right? Trillions of worlds. There, you have to allow in a world where the finite is evolving that it is possible that there are worlds where sin does not occur.
Yeah, and we have different stances on this. My stance is I don't think on any world, normal or otherwise, sin does not occur. What I think is
I look forward to our trip, our first trip to a sinless sphere.
Yeah. what I do think exists is that individuals on every normal world have the experience of knowing something is wrong, meaning it's not good, true, or beautiful, choosing it anyways,
yeah,
and having to struggle with that. I think that that is a universal experience on all normal worlds, and that that what is not at all a normal experience is that on a normal world, you have entire cultures and philosophies that encourage sinful activity and even iniquitous activity and atheistic activity. I think that is utterly abnormal for a normal world. So in other words, when the individual struggles with their own nature and makes poor choices, they live in a culture that 100% really supports choosing God, choosing God's way, and overcoming your infirmities and moving forward. And so they don't experience the marked struggle. They don't experience the marked struggle in a cultural context, and they don't experience the marked struggle in their own biochemistry and nature that we do, but they still deal with those issues, but they have so much more cultural support and so much more natural propensity that they relatively easily overcome those struggles. But I think the struggles are still there of that nature. I think, in other words, it's not simply confusion. It's also knowing and struggling and overcoming that struggle. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we are on a rebellion planet, so it's much easier for us to slide from, you know, a bad case of evil into something that might look, you know, could be almost defined as sin, because we have so many examples of that. It's almost a cultural norm in some sense.
Exactly.
But that's what we live with. So it's hard for us to imagine what life is like on a world that has not experienced rebellion, where permission has not been given for that sort of thing, where it's not been demonstrated by higher administrators and the people who work for them. We really have no way to fully imagine what that's like. So I don't know. Something big happens with rebellion, and again, I'm just trying to get a sense of what that is. But there's a number of comments here.
I'm going to remind us that we're here on the Cosmic Citizen, studying the spirit and the flesh. We've got just a little less than 30 minutes left, and I'm going to remind us that Paula's not here because she's celebrating this wonderful, wonderful, joyful time with her daughter, just having gotten married yesterday to a wonderful young man. And that's always a wonderful celebration. But I'm reminding us of that, too, because I don't think she ever would have allowed us to go this far with the back and forth that we're in right now. It's definitely feeling like it's all guys. Anyway, you know, you had the idea of going to Paper 17 for a particular quote. Do you have that quote handy there, Chuck?
Well,
let's have a look at that
section,
and round out this
study.
It's a
whole section in Paper 17.
Which
section
is it?
6 in Paper 17.
Well, let's go there. Let's tell our readers, our listeners, rather, that we're going to Paper 17, the 7 Supreme Spirit Groups, and Section 6 is dealing with, well, of all things, the local universe creative spirits. Great choice.
Mm-hmm. So this
is
where they map out
the 7 Supreme Spirit Groups, and do you want to read that, Chuck?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So this is kind of a review, in a way, of her emergence of her personal nature. So I think that's super fascinating, because we've already talked about that in connection with the Jubilee of Jubilees and when her power to create life was initiated and all of that, where she became more personal or more recognizable. So this section is fascinating because it maps that entire process for us, so we can see how it started and what its possible destiny might be. So the local universe creative spirits, the title of the section, says much that pertains to the nature and function of the local universe creative spirits properly belongs to the narrative of their association with the creator sons in the organization and management of the local creations, which is what we were just reading. But there are many features of the pre-local universe experiences of these marvelous beings, which may be narrated as a part of this discussion of the seven supreme spirit groups. We are conversant with six phases of the career of a local universe mother spirit, and we speculate much concerning the probability of a seventh stage of activity. These different stages of existence are, first, number one, initial paradise differentiation. This is almost romantic the way they talk about this. When a creator son is personalized by the joint action of the Father and the Eternal Son, simultaneously there occurs in the person of the Infinite Spirit what is known as the, quote, supreme reaction of complement. We do not comprehend the nature of this reaction, but we understand that it designates an inherent modification of those personalizable possibilities which are embraced within the creative potential of the conjoint creator, the Infinite Spirit. The birth of a coordinate creator son signalizes the birth within the person of the Infinite Spirit of the potential of the future local universe consort of this paradise son. Cognizant of this new pre-personal identification of entity, but we know that this fact finds place on the paradise records of the career of such a creator son. The second stage, number two, preliminary creatorship training. During the long period of the preliminary training of a Michael son, in the organization and administration of universes, his future consort undergoes further development of entity and becomes group conscious of destiny. We do not know, but we suspect that such a group conscious entity becomes space cognizant and begins that preliminary training requisite to the acquirement of spirit skill in her future work of collaboration with the complemental Michael in universe creation and administration, phase of physical creation. At the time the creatorship charge is administered to a Michael son by the Eternal Son, the master spirit who directs the super universe to which this new creator son is destined gives expression to the, quote, prayer of identification, unquote, in the presence of the Infinite Spirit. And for the first time, the entity of the subsequent creative spirit appears as differentiated from the person of the Infinite Spirit. And proceeding directly to the person of the petitioning master spirit, this entity is immediately lost to our recognition, becoming apparently a part of the person of this master spirit. And the master spirits, of course, are of origin in the Infinite Spirit. Anyway, this newly identified creative spirit remains with the master spirit until the moment of the departure of the creator son for the adventure of space, whereupon the master spirit commits this new spirit consort creator son, at the same time administering to the spirit consort the charge of eternal fidelity and unending loyalty. And then occurs one of the most profoundly touching episodes which ever take place on paradise. The Universal Father speaks in acknowledgement of the eternal union of the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit, and in confirmation of the bestowal of certain joint powers of administration by the master spirit of super universe jurisdiction.
Wow.
The Father United, Creator Son, and Creative Spirit then go forth on their adventure of universe creation, and they work together in this form of association throughout the long and arduous period of the material organization of their universe. The next stage is the life, number four, the life creation era. Upon the declaration of intention to create life, by the Creator Son, there ensue on paradise the, quote, personalization ceremonies participated in by the seven master spirits and personally experienced by the supervising master spirit. This is a paradise deity contribution to the individuality of the spirit consort of the Creator Son and becomes manifest to the universe in the phenomenon of the, quote, primary eruption in the person of the Infinite Spirit. Simultaneously with this phenomenon of paradise, the heretofore impersonal spirit consort of the Creator Son becomes, to all practical intents and purposes, a bona fide person. Henceforth and furthermore, this same local universe mother spirit will be regarded as a person and will remain and will maintain personal relations with all the personality hosts of the ensuing life creation. And then number five, the post-bestowal ages. That's the stage we're in now, as I understand it. Another and great change occurs in the never-ending career of the creative spirit when the Creator Son returns to universe headquarters after the completion of his seventh bestowal and subsequent to his acquirement of full universe sovereignty. On that occasion, before the assembled administrators of the universe, the triumphant Creator Son elevates the universe mother spirit to co-sovereignty and acknowledges the spirit consort as his equal. Then six is the ages of light and life. Upon the establishment of the era of light and life, the local universe co-sovereign enters upon a sixth phase of a creative spirit's career. But we may not portray the nature of this great experience. Such things pertain to a future stage of evolution in Nevadon. And then finally, number seven, because they always got to have an unrevealed part, the unrevealed career. We know of these six phases of the career of a local universe mother spirit. It is inevitable that we should ask, is there a seventh? We are mindful that when finaliters attain what appears to be their final destiny of mortal ascension, they are of record as entering upon the career of sixth stage spirits. We conjecture that there awaits the finaliters still another and unrevealed career in universe assignment. It is only to be expected that we would likewise regard the universe mother spirits as having ahead of them some undisclosed career, which will constitute their seventh phase of personal experience in universe service and loyal cooperation with the order of the Creator Michaels. So that's an interesting basis for that conjecture, that, you know, they know up to our sixth stage, but obviously if there's a sixth stage, there's going to be a seventh stage, right? So they're kind of saying the same thing about her, but not really knowing what that might look like.
Yeah, what a fascinating depiction of the evolution of a creative mother spirit. Go ahead, Marvin.
Well, I just had a question for you, Chuck, because you've studied this probably more than many of us. So the sixth and seventh stage of development for the universe mother spirit, I'm just guessing, and I'm wondering if you have any either passages or what your sense is, that when we look at our local universe, there will come a time when our local universe will be settled in light and life as a whole. But that will not, that will still be well short of the culmination of the age of the Supreme, which probably lies way out ahead of that. I'm wondering if there's any linkage between the sixth stage for the universe mother spirit and the settling in light and life, and whether the seventh stage is, it sounds like the implication is seventh stage for the universe mother spirit would be also like our seventh stage as finaliters, which would be at the culmination of the age of the Supreme and moving into, you know, that sort of gets to the role of Michael and mother spirit in the age of the ultimate, you know, out of the outer space levels, maybe.
I think other places they sort of hint at that. Without really knowing, of course, because it hasn't happened. But, yeah, there's talk about that possibility, which raises the question, you know, how could she leave the local universe without it all falling apart? You know, it's her gravity presence, in a sense, not just physically, but mindfully and spiritually, that, you know, she is the center. She does define the region of the local universe. And they say if she were to move, it would be pandemonium. So I don't know how that
well, without there being somehow mind being elevated. But you know what might be interesting, you know, as I'm looking at this, it's occurring to me to look at the fourth or local universe stage of light and life in paper 55, section 10, and I'm trying to see whether or not they're saying anything about her. But one of the things they do say in paragraph 4 is the settling of an entire local universe in light and life inaugurates profound readjustments in the entire scheme of administration from the individual inhabited world to the universe headquarters. New relationships extend down to the constellations and systems. The local universe mother spirit experiences new liaison relations with the master spirit of the super universe. A little bit of transfer of power here, or a transfer of function. And Gabriel establishes direct contact with the Ancients of Days to be effective when and as the Master Sun may be absent from the headquarters world, which we're told happens more and more as the creation becomes more and more settled. So there's that. And that would that would maybe hint as to how eventually the creative mother spirit, even before the actualization of the Supreme, would be able to perhaps begin to unseat or be less necessary. Because at that point, at that point of light and life, everybody's minds on every world are functioning pretty much attuned to the cosmic mind of Orvontin.
Skip down to paragraph 9.
Which is hard
9.
For us to imagine.
Maybe
go ahead.
Skip down to paragraph 9 in that same section. They explain a little bit more about what you just read there, I think.
You want to read it?
Sure. It says, speculation concerning the function of these creator suns in connection with the outer universes, now in process of preliminary assembly, is wholly futile. Okay, good. That's a good lead-in. But we all engage in such postulations from time to time. So funny how they talk like that. On attaining this fourth stage of development, the Creator Son becomes administratively free. The Divine Minister is progressively blending her ministry with that of the Super Universe Master Spirit and the Infinite Spirit. So she's blending her ministry with that of the Super Universe Master Spirit and the Infinite Spirit. There seems to be evolving a new and sublime relationship between the Creator Son, the Creative Spirit, Evening Stars, the Teacher Sons, and the ever-increasing Finaliter Core. So again, like what you just read a second ago, there's this implication that the Master Spirit maybe is gradually stepping in and will take over for her in some sense.
Well, you know,
directly, and that would free her. Well, here, this last paragraph, I got to read this too. So they say, we are, however, satisfied regarding two features of our speculations. If the Creator Sons are destined to the outer universes, the Divine Ministers will undoubtedly accompany them. We are equally sure that the Melchizedeks are to remain with the universes of their origin. We hold that the Melchizedeks are destined to play ever-increasing responsible parts in local universe government administration. But anyway, there it is right there. That's the part I was remembering. That the Divine Ministers will undoubtedly accompany the Creator Sons into the outer space levels.
Well, so here's an additional thing to think about. And again, they say, you know, it's futile to speculate, but we all do that. So here we are speculating.
Right.
And here's something else. I mean, they do say that the Mother Spirit is everywhere. You know, she functions independent of space. So she's everywhere in the local creation. And
that's
then
her pervading.
And there are indications that nature changes when the local universe is settled in light and life, and the not only the seventh master spirit, but also the infinite spirit, sort of partake with her in some of her function. It's entirely possible that in the age of the ultimate, the mother spirit will be able to both be resident in the local universe, maintaining her functions in association with a master spirit and the infinite spirit, and also be out there in the outer space levels because she functions independent of space. She could be there in both places.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's not a contradiction there necessary between both those functions and both those locations.
Yeah. But this is a new way of talking about her. The idea that she would leave the local universe, personally, in some sense.
Yeah.
She wouldn't leave it.
Her mind function being taken over, first of all, by the master spirit and the infinite spirit as a result of that kind of blending and the fact that you know, the creatures of the realm are more and more capable of utilizing that. But furthermore, the Supreme Being is destined to have Supreme Mind be more and more available. And so with that, there will be a mindedness available to the local universe, which will free her up, basically, to leave.
See, I don't think she necessarily has to leave. She could be in both places. She could simply extend her presence. She would be both in the local universe and extended. Her presence would be extended with Michael out in the wherever he was in the outer universes of outer space. She would simply expand her presence.
That's a possibility too, I suppose. Yeah.
In that case, we're talking about the incredible, that sounds very personal.
Okay.
You know, it should be stretched a little thin, I think, you know, swirling in one direction in the outer space level and then swirling in this direction here, that might be a bit of a trick, but I will not let my imagination be curtailed. If Marvin says it could be possible, who knows?
You're right.
Speculation
is futile, but we do it anyway.
the thing is we're thinking materially, right? I mean, her presence is not a material reality. It's a spiritual reality which doesn't have limitations spatially or even temporally. So she could be, you know, I mean, the Father is everywhere at once and is not attenuated at all, as is the infinite spirit. So, you know, I mean, they're definitely...
Well, the infinite spirit also has omnipresence, That's a feature currently of the Mother Spirit within her local universe, but that's ultimately a feature. I mean, it comes to her from the infinite spirit. So,
right. She could be present in both locations without in any way being attenuated, is my point.
Maybe. I don't know. It's possible, certainly. But they do say here in the beginning of paragraph 4 that the settling of an entire local universe in light and life inaugurates profound readjustments in the entire scheme of administration. So who knows what that means, but it sounds, they say the new relationships extend down to the constellations and systems. And this, you know, the comment about how she experiences a new liaison relations with the master spirit, that sounds...
Yeah.
Like it's part of the same picture, so who knows? Speculate, even though it's cute.
There was something that caught me at the very last paragraph of a section in the Spirit and Man that might be worth mentioning, where they say, having started out on the way of life everlasting, having accepted the assignment and received your orders to advance, which is kind of like where we are, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do not fear the dangers of human forgetfulness and mortal inconstancy. Do not be troubled with doubts of failure or by perplexing confusion. Do not falter and question your status and standing. The implication is that even having started out on the way of everlasting and accepted the assignment to advance, that doesn't mean we don't still struggle with human forgetfulness, mortal inconstancy, doubts of failure, perplexing confusion. Those things still are with us. What they're saying is don't fear them and don't be troubled by them. You know, in other words, let them recede in their importance. They're more in the background. But I think it's worth noting that we don't escape them entirely until we leave the human condition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're just saying, don't be bothered. You know, yeah. So, I mean, I think that's good to keep in mind. You know,
well, it's a great way to cap off our discussion here today. We've got about 3.5 minutes. I'm wondering if you can then go ahead and preview next week, Marvin, again on homecoming, which is going to be essentially talking about the worship service that you and your cohort will be conducting at 10 o'clock Pacific time on every second Sunday. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So we're starting over the summer to meet every second Sunday, starting June 12th. So pretty much every second Sunday from that point on. And then in the fall, we hope to actually move to every Sunday at 10 a.m. Pacific, as you mentioned, on Sundays. And it's hour long. We may have an after experience. It's like a fellowship time of more informal gathering. But our purpose in creating homecoming is to try to create a venue that is spiritually nourishing for folks who are people who are your Ranch Book readers, but also people who are spiritual seekers in a broader sense from the interfaith movement, who are kind of progressive seekers from within their own traditions, and even those who are spiritual not religious, a variety of broader audiences really that are spiritually hungry and spiritually searching, and to try to create a context where there's a place for spiritual community and mutual support, and also a place for quiet communion and joining with the divine, with God's presence in quiet interior worship. And also a third component is we'll have breakouts, three-person breakouts, where there's an opportunity for everyone to interact a little bit with each other and not just be a passive audience, but really enjoy some participation, all in an hour format. And the theme for homecoming is that we're all part of a broader spiritual family, and we're all seeking to come home, in a sense, to our relationships with each other in spiritual family, with God, and to try and find a way to have our lives uplifted and suffused with that experience. And so homecoming is an attempt to help us all do that and reach out to a broader audience with that set of possibilities. So we're hopeful. We'll see. It's a kind of a bold adventure, but we're excited at trying to start it up and move it forward. So join in next Saturday, and we'll have, I think, a conversation on Cosmic Citizen that really, with a vision team behind homecoming, Elizabeth Callahan and Angie Thurston, Alice Wood, Paula, myself, and Will Rucker, and we'll sort of unpack it more and chat about
the possibilities. Is there a particular event upcoming? Is there an event upcoming that we should know about?
June 12th. 10 a.m. Okay. June 12th, Sunday, 10 a.m. That'll be the kickoff worship service for homecoming. And then every other Sunday, starting from June 12th, every other Sunday over the summer, and then starting in the fall, every Sunday, we hope.
So that'll be on Zoom?
They should be able to find that out at yourranchouniversity.org. There should be something on the website about that. Well, wonderful. We're down to our last 10 seconds. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on the Cosmic Citizen. Marvin and Chuck, it's been a pleasure, and
I look forward to being with you soon on this wonderful program together. Have a great week, you guys.
Okay.
Thanks, you Andre.
Too. It's been fun.
Yep.
It has lots of love to
and thank you to our listeners, Isadora Perry,
hey.
Vaughn,
yeah, absolutely,
and Kim. Nice to have you there, and also Pam. Until next time.
Perfect.
Bye for
all
now.
All righty. Thanks, Andre, for hosting today.
Yeah, thank you Andre. Great job.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.